Okay, my name is Jim Schaefer's and I'm an alcoholic. As long as I'm starting out by admitting on certain things, I should admit I'm also a ex-car salesman. And the reason I say that is so that you'll understand why I didn't have any problem with the rigorous honesty in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I remember the first AA meeting I ever went to. It was at an AA clubhouse in Reseda, California. Seems there was a judge in Van Nuys that didn't have much of a sense of humor. I was trying to tell him one morning after I stuffed the drunk off of the tank that, you know, I was a married man with six kids. I had a good job, a lot of responsibilities. Once in a while, I just, you know, I go out and have a couple drinks and things just happen. So he looked at me and he looked at my my rap sheet, which was kind of long. Now, you got to remember, back then, this was in the early 70s. They didn't know what to do with drugs like me. You know, there were very few treatment centers. I've never heard of a treatment center. And what are they going to do with a drug? Throw in jail overnight? They didn't put them in prison then, anything else. So the judge said, X amount of AA meetings and X amount of days. I thought, okay, that's easy. So they sent me next door to meet a guy who had a suit and a tie on. And he introduced himself and said he was an alcoholic. Well, I had never seen an alcoholic with a suit and a tie on. I thought the guy was bullshitting me. So he gave me a list of 20 questions that I was supposed to answer. And I ripped my way through those questions, and he looked at him and he said, good chance you're an alcoholic. And I'm thinking to myself, just let's get this get it over there when we get out of here. I got things to do. So he gave me a directory of meetings. Now in Southern California, at that time, there were over 1,000 meetings a week. So I'm in the San Fernando Valley, and I'm looking at this meeting directory, and I'm trying to figure out what meetings I can go to at what time. Well, I saw this meeting at the Nest, the clubhouse, and it was at noon. And it's not too far from the dealership I was managing. So I got in my car and I drove until I found the address, and then I drove about four blocks away from that address, parked my car because I didn't want to see anybody to see my car there, and walked to the meeting. And I got to the door and opened the door, and you had to walk up a big flight of steps. So I walked up the steps, and there was some nice little old lady up at the top of the steps. And she said, hi, how are you? I'm so-and-so. I said, hi. And she said, would you like a cup of coffee? I said, you know, that would be nice. So she took me over to a table where they had coffee. And I fixed myself a black coffee, and she said, how about a donut? And I thought, wait a minute, she thinks I'm one of them. There's no way I'm going to have one of your goddamn donuts. And I said, no, that's okay, thank you. And so then I turned around, I didn't know what I was supposed to do. So she directed me over to a big round table. And then somebody read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started talking about God. And I thought, am I in the right place? And then they started talking about living a life of rigorous honesty. I said, man, they don't know who they're talking to here. I got a wife and six kids that are depending on me making the money, and they want me to be rigorously honest when I'm in the car business? Uh-uh. Ain't going to work for this guy. So I listened to him anyway, and then he started sharing. I didn't know what sharing was, but each one at the table started telling a little bit about himself. And they were all goofs. One girl who was a good-looking girl sat there and told about going out on dates, having dinner and having a bunch of drinks and getting drunk, going out in the middle of the street, taking her clothes off. And I'm thinking, what in the hell kind of people are these? And everybody started talking. All of a sudden, somebody said, how about you? Then I looked around and I said, wait a minute, people. I said, my case is different. I said, I'm a high-powered sales manager in the automobile business. I have a wife and six children. I have a nice home up in the up in the hills overlooking the San Fernando Valley. I got a swimming pool in my backyard. And I run one of the most profitable Chevrolet dealerships in California. And once in a while, I just go out and I'm maybe a little tired or whatever. I have a couple drinks and things just happen. Well, there's one guy at that round table that looked like an ex-punch front fighter. And he looked up at me and he said, "Oh, you're full of shit." He said, "Your problem is you drink too much." Well, at that time, I never knew what a resentment was. But I developed my first AA resentment right then. And, you know, I was so mad at that guy at that meeting that I said, "You're not even going to sign my paper." I had it right in my pocket. So I walked out of that meeting and I wouldn't let him sign my paper. And then I, you know, had to get down to brass tacks and find another meeting to go to. And it was a Sunday night meeting and called the Woodland Hills Action Group. And so I went to it. And it was a speaker meeting, like this. And a bunch of chairs lined up and I sat in the last row because that's where new people sit. And I sat there, and it was a 10-minute speaker at the beginning, and then a main speaker after a coffee break. So the 10-minute speaker spoke, and then they had the 12th tradition, or whatever the hell they call that thing, and then the coffee break. So I grabbed a cup of coffee and went outside, and three big guys followed me outside. And I mean, they were big. One guy was an ex-football player that had been thrown off the Oakland Raiders for drinking. Finished his career in Canada. Another guy was an ex-heavyweight fighter who had fought for the World Championship. And another guy was an ex-man of New York. And these three guys grabbed me, and they did what alcoholics are supposed to do to new people. They started talking Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And I said, "Wait a minute. You guys don't understand. My case is different. I have a wife and six children. I have a nice house. I have a swimming pool in the backyard. I have a job running a Chevrolet dealership, one of the most profitable Chevrolet dealerships in California." And I said, "I just, once in a while, I stop and have a drink with the guys." And I'd be dead if another guy didn't say, "You're full of shit." And it was the ex-heavyweight fighter. He said, "I'm the general manager of the largest Ford dealership in the United States." He says, "Your problem is you drink too much." Well, that was my second resentment in two meetings. So I couldn't wait to get out of that meeting, and I turned around and looked at it, and I said, "See ya, AA." And I left. And I never knew how truthful that statement was when I said, "See ya, AA." Because in my mind, I was not an alcoholic. And to really tell my story, I really have to start at the beginning. And the beginning happened on my earliest recollection on 24th Street in Detroit, Michigan. That's where I was raised. And I lived in this big house on 24th Street with a woman I called Mother, who hated me. A guy I called Dad, who loved me. A grandmother who was from the old country, from Germany, who loved me and protected me against my mother. People that lived upstairs were my aunt and uncle, because my dad had made apartments up there. People who lived in back of us. My dad had made an apartment was another aunt and uncle. And I was raised with this family and went to a Catholic school for 12 years of my life. But my earliest recollection was feeling strange, like I was different from anybody else. And I couldn't put my finger on the feeling, but I was extremely sensitive. My feelings were hurt very easily. And I didn't find out until I was about 14 years old that all these feelings of not belonging and everything, when I was rummaging through the attic of the house one day, and I ran across the picture. And it was a picture out of a newspaper. And it was a picture of a little kid sitting down, and they called him flaxen-haired Bobby Gordon, and they were looking for his mother. And that was me. What had happened, this is back in the Depression years, my real father, I found out later on, got deported to Canada for writing bad checks. My mother used to board me out with these people while she worked, and she would come visit me on weekends. One weekend she never showed up. So now I'm left with these people. My dad wanted to keep me, my grandmother wanted to keep me, and my mother, who had just lost a baby, didn't. So I grew up in that environment, feeling different, feeling threatened most of the time, fears that I never knew what they were caused by, sensitivity that if you hurt my feelings, the first thing I wanted to do was fight you. But after a while, when you get in a lot of fights, you decide maybe there's a different way. So I would start thinking at you. That was easier. I was thinking what I could do to you. Maybe I could get you down and pull your goddamn fingernails out. I don't know. But I became a thinker and a daydreamer. And my earliest recollections of daydreams were every Saturday we would go to the movies and would watch cowboy movies. And my heroes were Roy Rogers, Singing Cowboy, with his horse trigger. And then there was Buck Rogers and a whole bunch of Western actors. And I'd watch that movie and I would go to bed at night. And I would be one of those cowboys. And I would go into the neighborhood and clean up all the jerks that I didn't like. And get on my horse and ride off, and all the little girls in the neighborhood would be waving to me and crying because I wasn't stopping to say goodbye to them. And then I got a little older, and I discovered baseball. And I love baseball. I was pretty good at baseball. We have a little team called the Wizards in Detroit. Played in the school grounds. And I was a starter. And I lived not too far from Tiger Stadium, which was known as Brick Stadium in those days. And we would see some of the ball games. And I had a hero by the name of Hank Greenberg. And he was the home run hitter. And I would go to bed at night, and I would dream about being that baseball player. And again, I'm at Tiger Stadium or Brick Stadium. All my friends and all the guys I don't like are there. And it's the ninth inning, and I'm up at the bases loaded, and I hit the game-winning home run, and I trot around the bases. And I just know that all those people that I don't like are going to be sorry that they weren't nicer to me. And that's who I was. And then I got a little bit older, and puberty hit, and I discovered sex. And I liked that. I said, yeah, this is where it's at. I'm going to practice this till I'm the best that there is. And I did. And the problem was, in those days, I never had a partner. All right. See, that's called rigorous honesty. But anyway, I grew up and went to high school and played a couple sports. Small Catholic school, when you play a couple sports, you're a hero. Everybody likes you. And got out of high school, and I really didn't know what to do with myself. I had no inclination to go to college, and I just had nothing I could do. So I did what everybody else in Detroit did in those days. I went to work for automobile. Cadillac Motor Car Company, and I worked on the assembly line. And I played, I still played baseball. It was good baseball. So I played for one of the better teams in Detroit, Class A. And I had a couple scouts for the major leagues scout me. And at that time, there were only 16 major league teams, so if you're scouted by a scout from one of those teams, you're pretty good. And one of the scouts said he was going to be back in town in a couple of weeks. And he wanted to sit down and talk to me. Well, having an alcoholic personality, which I didn't know I had, but it's a personality that you're afraid to fail and you're afraid to win. So I joined the Navy before that 2 weeks was up. So there went my shot at making the major leagues, which I wanted to do all my life. And I went in the Navy, and I got into boot camp, became the athletic petty officer of my company. I was second in the honor man for the company when they vote to the company who they think is the most popular, whatever guy. I came in second in the voting on that. So I was a pretty popular guy. And then I went to a school in Jacksonville, Florida. And that's when my life really began. One of my first liberties in Jacksonville, Florida, I met some guys from New Jersey and New York. And we went into a bar to get a drink. I'd never been in a bar. I'd never had a drink in a bar. I didn't even know how to order it. So I asked one of the guys, what do I order? He said, order a Coke High. I said, what's that? He said, whiskey and Coke. I said, okay. So I ordered it. The waitress brought it over, or the waiter, whoever it was. And I tasted it. And it was special. It didn't do anything special for me, except one thing. And it's almost infinitesimal. It made me feel like I belonged. This was a comfort thing. I'm here with all the guys. We're sitting there having a drink, BSing, and I'm one of them. And it was a good feeling. And I carried that feeling through 4 years in the Navy. I was on 3 aircraft carriers in a lot of countries. And most of the crew, or a lot of the crew, would go ashore when you pulled into a shore with that camera over their shoulder. And all I wanted was some money in my pocket. Because I went to the nearest bar, had a few drinks with the guys, and then we started looking for a house to go with you. And that's what I did in every port that I ever met. And I used to brag about it. And then I got out of it. And another thing I learned to do in the Navy was smoke marijuana. A bunch of guys and I, we had rented a house in Mission Beach, stationed at Miramar. And I used to go to Tijuana and buy the marijuana, take it back to our little house, and I'd clean it, roll it, sell it. And I was on night check at Miramar, which meant I went in at 5 o'clock at night, pulled the checks on the airplane, and I went home at 10 or 11 o'clock. And the master at arms at the Chow Hall was a black guy who was a good friend of mine, and I would give him a lot of joints that he would sell and give me the money for it. And he kept selling them for himself. And that's the way I lived that last year in the Navy. I was going to go to acting school because I wanted to be an actor. And the guys that I lived with wanted to be actors too. We had one guy that was just like Tony Curtis. I'll tell you, he was one good looking son of a gun. We used to put him on a bus and send him to San Diego. And he'd come back with 7, 8 women. I mean, he was that good. And so we were all going to go to school in Pasadena. And Vince got killed one Saturday night. He was working in La Jolla at the hotel as a busboy. And he got killed driving from the hotel back to our place. And that just ended us all. We all left. He said, one guy who did go on to acting school, he became quite an actor. I see him every now and then in movies, married a very famous actress. And I never did like the guy anyway, but he became quite an actor. Went back to Michigan, I didn't know what I was going to do. Somehow or other, I drifted into the automobile business, and I was made for the car business. I was an introvert in an extroverted business. And for me to succeed, I had to be outgoing. So I did it. It was all an act, but it worked. And I became quite good at it. They had a girl up in the office who was built like you can't believe. And everybody at the dealership was after her. Nobody could get her. And we were sitting there talking about it one day. Guys talk about those things, you know. And I said, I'll get her. And they said, you will, man. I said, you want to bet on it? So I made a few bets with the guy. He said, I did. And I'll be damned if she could get pregnant. And being in a Catholic upbringing I had and everything else, what could I do? I took her to Las Vegas and married her. And we moved to L.A. and I looked up some old friends of mine from the Navy. and I lived there. He bought a house and a lot of money. And the marriage was doomed from the start. Took her back to Michigan, left her, and just kind of bummed her on. Lived at YMCA for a while, but other places. Didn't know what to do. Got back into the car business. Started making some money. Met another girl. Met her at the bus stop outside the dealership. A friend of mine said, "Hey, you got to see the girl out there with the good legs." I said, "Where?" So he showed me to her, and so I just went up and talked to her and made a date with her. And the next thing you know, she had two kids, and she's pregnant. Said, "I only got one on the way, and she's got two kids, and I can't make it because I got to pay child support on the other one I got." She just found out from back to California we came. And I had to get out of town. So we did that. I made another trip back to Michigan and back to California again. And then I became successful. I became very good at my business. And the owner came to me one day and he said, "I might be able to get a Madison store." I said, "Okay." So I did. Now all this time, I want you to understand one thing. Because I'm talking about alcohol. Alcohol has become part of my life. I have the same idea as I had when I was in that bar in Jacksonville, Florida. Alcohol is for camaraderie, for friendship. It's to let your hair down and relax and be one of the guys. And when you're in a stressful job like I had, you need that. My drinking changed. I used to drink scotch because I wanted to look important. So I drank scotch until I discovered I didn't like scotch. It tasted like medicine. I didn't even know why I drank the stuff. And one day I'm having lunch at a place called the Ram's Horn. And I have lunch with these friends of mine. And I started ordering martinis. Wow. That was it. I'm telling you, my first martini, and I was hooked. I liked what it tasted like, and I loved what it did. It changed my personality. It made me who I wanted to be. I became one of the smartest guys in the bar. If you wanted to talk religion, I'd talk religion to you. If you wanted to talk politics, I'd talk politics with you. If you wanted to talk sports, I'd talk sports. And I knew more than you did. I also became a pretty good fighter. Because when you know it all, you got to defend what you say sometimes. So I became a pretty good fighter. And last but not least, all that practice I had when I was a kid was going to pay off now because I became a lover. And I used to go in that bar and I'd order my drink and I'd sit there and look in that mirror in the bar and I'd say, "You handsome son of a bitch. What female is going to know pleasures like she's never known before in her life tonight?" And I would look around the room and pick out the best looking girl in that room and I'd go after her. And I'd say, I didn't lose very often. Sometimes I'd go up there and they'd say, "Get lost." I'd say, "Okay, you're my kind of girl." And I go after it, and a lot of times I win. And I have a lot of fun. I mean, I have a lot of fun. Forgot that I was married and had six kids. You know, it just seemed I was leading a life that I don't know how I led it. I work all day, drink all night, and go home. I have a son who told me one day, not too long ago, within the last 3 or 4 years, he said, "Dad, do you remember when you used to go in the morning and get up and jump in the swimming pool and start swimming lengths?" He said, "One morning you got out of the pool and you said, 'Man, I must be Superman.'" And he said, "You know, I remember that. I remember that all these years because I felt like Superman. I felt like I was indestructible. I felt like I could do anything. The booze was working for me the way it's supposed to work for an alcohol. It made me who I wanted to be." But if it does that for you, you keep on drinking. It's that simple. So I drank it. And then I started drinking too much. And the police started stopping me. And I started getting what they call 502 tickets. Which are drunk driving tickets. And because I was slick and I made good money, I managed to get out of all those tickets. Until that day I was in front of the judge. And he had a disadvantage. Because I'd slept all night on the drunk tank. And my Beverly Hills suit was all wrinkled. My dress shirt was wrinkled. My hair that I had styled wasn't combed, because I didn't have a comb. And my shoes were all scuffed, so he didn't really get a good look at the real jersey. He just saw what had happened. So he sent me down to ICE. And when I went to those two meetings and wouldn't go back, I had to go back in front of the judge to figure out how to get out of this. And you know what I did? I got up that morning, I showered, shaved, put on a fresh suit, new shirt, a tie, had my shoes shined, and I went up in front of that judge. I said, Your Honor, I said, you know, I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings ever since then. I was here. I said, you know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had a drink since then. I said, I don't know what happened to that paper. I had it all signed and everything. I don't know what happened to it. You know, I wasn't a good car salesman for nothing. He bought the story. He really did. Well, I wish he'd come in the showroom and let me sell my car. I left that courthouse, and I went to the Ram's Horn, and there were my buddies all there, and proceeded to get ripped again. And it wasn't too long until I got there. I got ripped again, and it wasn't too long before I was back in the courtroom again, and it wasn't too long before I was moving out of my house at 3 o'clock in the morning, because I didn't want the neighbors to see me. We were foreclosing on my house. In a year that I made more money than I'd ever made in my life. And I couldn't pay for my house. And I no longer had that job. I no longer had my driver's license. I got a rented house in Westlake Village because I was class, and I had to go with the class. So I rented a big house in Westlake Village, moved my family in there. I got a job working for a friend of mine who used to work for me. And my wife was going into the hospital to have an operation one morning. And I was supposed to take her to the hospital. They closed the dealership that I was working at about 15 minutes early. And the bar that I drank at was right next door to the dealership. So I said, you know what? I got time for one quickie before I go. Never made it home. I don't know where I ended up. Because I was in a black car. I started having these little mini blackouts. I started finding myself on the streets that I didn't know where I was. Don't know how I got there. I found myself waking up in bed with strange people. I had to, because I was scared, I had to reach over and make sure that they had boobs so I wasn't in bed with the wrong person. So that's the way I was living. And that's what had happened to me. I was remorseful. I went to see my wife. She wouldn't talk to me. So I went to a telephone at the supermarket in Westlake. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And a nice little guy came over, 12-step me, and took me to a meeting, took me to a couple other meetings, and never turned. I couldn't quit drinking. Now, It was becoming such a big problem that I knew I had to stop, and I couldn't. I tried switching it. I tried all the things that they talked about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. None of it worked. And I thought about this after I got sober. I thought, I tried to put everything together. Was, how did I go from that guy who just liked to have a couple drinks to be one of the guys, to a fall down, blackout, drink and drunk? How did it happen? I tried to put it all together. And by doing this, I came up with an analogy that made sense to me. And you have to have a little imagination. You've got to imagine that you're going to an amusement park. And in this amusement park, they have a ride called the roller coaster. And you get on that roller coaster. And what the roller coaster does is it climbs way up, very slow. You can hear the chains climbing. And it gets way up to the top. And it goes down fast. And it gives you a thrill. That's great. And then it goes around the curves and everything else. And it's fun. Finally, you get so brave, if you're like me, just you have your hands up in the air to show everybody how brave you are. This thing is going down and around the curves and everything else. And then it starts to get a little faster. And it gets a little scary. And this is kind of scary now. This isn't too much fun. So it does something strange. It goes down to the bottom and stops. One off get up. And most of the people get up. But if you're an alcoholic like me, you think to yourself, no, because it's going to go back to the way it was when I got out. So you stay on, and it takes off again, and it's not slow this time. It's breakneck speed, and it's going as fast as it can go. And now it's really scary. And you're just sitting on that roller coaster that's hitting all these curves and up and down and everything else, and you know that if you don't get off of it, you're going to die. And if you try to get off of it, you're going to die. And you don't know what to do. You're lost. And that's where I was at on May the 20th, 1974. I was lost, and I couldn't get off that roller coaster. And I tried and tried and tried, and it just wouldn't work. Finally, something happened to me that I can't explain today. But my form of surrender came in a simple little prayer I said. I was at a bar in Sherman Oaks, California, called Ricky's Valley Inn. And I ordered a vodka martini, straight up with a twist. The waitress brought it over, set it in front of me. It was my first drink of the day. And I took one look at it, and I said to myself, God help me, I don't want it anymore. And at that moment, I had what I've heard people say at Alcoholics Anonymous, a moment of clarity. I saw myself standing in a tunnel all the way down to the end. And the guy that had his hairstyle, nails manicured, wore the Beverly Hills suits, shirts, valley, loafers, everything else, was standing there in a pair of slacks that were wrinkled, an old white shirt that was dirty, a pair of green and white tennis shoes on, and a gray golf sweater. I said to myself, oh my God, how did I turn into this? And I walked out of that bar, I was off that roller coaster. But the problem is, I've been off that roller coaster before. My problem was staying on it. Because if you're an alcoholic, the worst place in the world for you is not to drink. So it's very scary. You know, I quit 3 days at a time, a week at a time. Never could make 30 days, because I tried. So I went back to work. But I had said that simple prayer, God help me. And I got back to work, and I got a phone call. You remember me talking about this ex-football player? Well, in a weak moment, at one of the meetings that I went back to in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd asked this guy to be my sponsor. And he made some demands on me that I couldn't handle. He wanted me to call him every morning. I said, what am I supposed to say? He said, say good morning. Then he wanted me to go to meetings every night. I said, I can't go to meetings every night. He said, did you drink every night? I said, what's that? What does that have to do with it? So I couldn't do those things. But the real truth of the matter was, I couldn't quit drinking. That was the real truth. So he called me on the phone and he said, how are you? I said, I'm pretty good. His name was Keith Carpenter. I can say that because he's dead now. And I can honestly say that when he died, my wife will tell you this, I cried for 3 straight days. I love that man that much. So I went to a meeting with that night. And it was in West Los Angeles, on Ohio Street, at a place called the Pacific Room. And it was a speaker meeting like this. The speaker came out in a blue suit and a white shirt, and he strode up to a podium. And I took one look at him, and I immediately took his inventory. I said, look at that arrogant little son of a bitch. And he got up to the podium, and he looked around the room, and he said, my name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. And the place shook. I thought the roof was going to come out and flop the place. Everybody yelled, hi, Clancy. And I'm sitting there. And Clancy starts to talk. And he talks about being in a Texas insane asylum. He talked about having his teeth kicked in the jail in Juarez. And he's making fun of him. And I'm listening to this guy and everybody's laughing, including him. And I'm thinking, this guy's not arrogant, he's nuts. And then he said something, and that was May the 20th, 1974, that I've never forgotten. He looked around the room, and I don't know where it came from, but he said, alcohol is your problem. You're in the wrong place. There's no help for you here. And I bolted up in my seat. I said, what the hell is this guy talking about? He said, if alcohol is your problem, I'm going to give you a solution to your problem. And you're never, ever going to have to go to another AA meeting. He said, if alcohol is your problem, don't drink it, for Christ's sakes. And I'm dumbfounded. I'm looking at him. He said, but if you've tried that, for some reason or other, life becomes so untenable out there that you find yourself drinking again. He said, perhaps you suffer from what I suffer from. And it's called alcoholism. He said, those 3 letters are what kill people, put them into institutions and jails, and give them lives of misery. He said, if that's what your problem is, you're in the right place. And I have never forgotten that. I walked out of that meeting, and like I said again, that was May the 20th, 1974, and I have not found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol, smoke a marijuana cigarette, use a smack suppository, or any other apothecary accoutrement that affects you from the neck up. And you know what? My life is great. If somebody would have told me this 34 years ago, that I had all this to look forward to, there's no way I could have believed it. Because I believe now that Alcoholics Anonymous does for me exactly what alcohol did for me years ago. Alcohol years ago made me comfortable, and it made me fit in. And that's why I kept on drinking. Alcoholics Anonymous, over a longer period of time, made me comfortable, and makes me fit in. And I don't have any hangover when I wake up tomorrow. And I know where I was the night before when I wake up. And I can look my wife in the eye and tell her I love her. I don't have to worry about saying, hey, I'm sleeping with something. Bimbo the night before or whatever. I see my kids, my grandkids. Life is good. My sponsor ended up being that guy that was a speaker at that meeting when I first at Indian up in the city. He ended up being my sponsor for the last 30 some years. In fact, I talked to him tonight in the car going home with my wife. And I said, well, I'll call you next week. He said, no, you won't. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, he said, I had something happening. He said that I might not come through. I said, oh, shit, what's wrong now? He said, well, I got to go to Ireland and tell those people not to drink. You see, that's what he does. He's been to Denmark, to Norway, to Ireland, to Scotland, to England, to Russia. He's been all over the world teaching the AA program. And, you know, a lot of people say, how does AA work? And there's a lot of answers. People say, you know, I don't know, works just fine, whatever else. What I think, or what I believe, that's got me sober for 34 years, is that I have a mind and a brain that has tried to save me. The reason I drank is because it made me feel good. When I felt bad, the brain said, drink. If I was too happy, I drank, and it made me feel bad. The brain shut all these things, shut all these secrets to me. And that's why psychologists, psychiatrists, and doctors cannot get alcoholics to stop drinking. Because they can pour information in their head, everything else. And then the alcoholic, after they keep them dry, like my sponsor makes this remark, they've got this guy in their brainwashing and everything else. And he goes out, he's got a report, a week later he comes in and smashed, and he says, how come you're drunk? What's the matter? And he says, they looked at me funny on the bus. And these psychiatrists and psychologists don't understand that. That alcoholics see reality different than them. And that's why they can't help us. But the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, with all the actions it requires you to take, going to meetings in action, getting sponsors in action, working the 12 steps are actions, sticking your hand out and shaking hands of a newcomer, that's an action. All those actions change your thinking. Psychologists think they got to change your thinking so your actions change. Well, it doesn't work with the argument. That's what I believe, and it's kept me sober for over 34 years. And thank you for sitting here listening to me. Now we don't have to go to the question and answer, right?